The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
And we made it to a Friday. Oh, it's so good when a Friday comes around and we're still here. You know, each week I question whether or not we'll make it to the end of the week, but we're here, so good on us, right? Hey, a quick promo while I'm thinking about it. You know, a few months ago, we started doing this Monday music thing. So on Mondays, the show begins as usual. You know, I kick it off usually with hopefully something funny to give us a little laugh at the beginning of the show. And I run down the latest news and information, things we need to know at this point in the day. So we do that. The first half hour of the show is basically, you know, a little bit of funny news and information and occasionally something else. And then, oh, my audio is weird again, huh? All right, let me know if this gets any better. I tested it, so you let me know. Hopefully that will be a little better. The audio was quite strong, you're telling me, huh? All right, well, hopefully that helped a little bit. Let me know. So anyway, I saw YouTube is scratchy. All right. Well, hopefully, all right, I'm bringing it down a bit, and hopefully that helps. Let me know. YouTubers, you're going to have to let me know. All right, so Monday, our musical guest is James McMurtry. Now, a lot of people should know James McMurtry because he's been making amazing music for decades now, and he's quite outspoken. He's very political in not only his music, but in what he writes on his website as well, jamesmcmurtry.com. And he also has a really famous father. His father is Larry McMurtry. I'm glad it's Friday because my mouth isn't working well. Author of Lonesome Dove and The Last Picture Show and all those amazing books. So he comes from quite a literary family, and he's quite literary himself. So James McMurtry, our musical guest on Monday Music this coming Monday. So we'll see you then. Some people still don't know that I'm doing a Monday show. We're now on 5 days a week here on the Progressive Voices Network, on NicoleSandler.com, on YouTube, on Facebook Live, on Netroots Radio, on Air Progressive, on FYI Nation, and a number of other internet outlets around the world. So however you listen, I think. And of course, the podcast is always available. All right. You know, I like to start things off with a funny. And I told you the other day, I had sort of a wealth of videos to choose from because a bunch of them all came on at the same time. Oh, good. Jabbermocky says, I love James McMurtry. Yes, fabulous singer-songwriter. So that's a treat. And I've got some other really good ones lined up. I've been reaching out to friends and former acquaintances, some people that I haven't spoken to in a few decades, too. So hopefully, you know, you'll get some good listening musical treats coming up in the next few weeks too. All right, sorry, I'm jumping around. Back to the funny. So let's see. This week we already heard from Randy Rainbow. We heard from the Kiffness. We heard from Founder Sing. And who among our regulars is still out there? Well, that would be the Parody Project. This guy Don Caron does these songs, and he's been doing it for years. He didn't just start with the coronavirus with the insanity that has made people around the world start making these parody videos. No, they've been doing this for a while now. And the latest one, like, Don Caron is a bit morose, might be the word. His videos, they're funny, but there's an underlying cynicism and bit of fed upness, if that's a word, one that I just coined. Anyway, well, you'll see what I mean when you hear this song. It is a Beatles parody, and it's called Stupidly Bigly. It's the Parody Project on the Nicole Sandler Show. Take it away, Don Caron. Oh, it says Cipolla's five fundamental laws of stupidity. Everyone underestimates the number of stupid people in circulation. The probability that someone is stupid is unrelated to the person's other traits. A stupid person inflicts loss on others with no gain to him or herself. A non-stupid person underestimates the damaging power of stupid people. Of all the people on the planet, stupid people are the most dangerous.
And as I'm studying, one out of four think the sun daily orbits the earth. For what it's worth, there's the flat earthers swearing the earth is a disc you can fall off the edge. So they allege all the stupid people. Stupid people, where do they all belong? Man in the White House doesn't believe in the science in front of his face. It's a disgrace, people believe him, even when death is the cost of ignoring the facts. Never retracts all the stupid people, where do they all come from? Stupid people, where do they all belong? Look at all the stupid people. Look at all the stupid people. Human condition, no one's exempt from effects of the brain's fatal flaw. A natural law forming up in based on beliefs that are carried from birth to the grave. No one is saved. All the stupid, look at all the stupid. Where do they all come from? All the stupid, look at all the stupid. We may not be here long.
Ah, that was it. Oh boy, it was a quickie. Hold on. Oh yes, all the stupid people, stupidly bigly. Why is there no audio there? All right, hopefully YouTube. Oh, there we go. Okay. Again, the Parody Project, Don Karen, parodyproject.com. All the stupid people, and they are everywhere, aren't they? I will post that video on the blog at NicoleSandler.com along with the podcast of today's show. So if you want to see the video that went with that, I told you, I mean, funny, but not like, yeah, not haha funny, but curiously funny. All right. Let's take a very quick break. We're going to come back on the other side and speak with the woman who is trying to unseat Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Yes, it's not my district here in Florida, but the next one over. I'm in the 22nd. Debbie Wasserman Schultz has been riding herd over the 23rd district for way too long. And now we've got a wonderful candidate named Jen Pearlman, who's primarying her. And the election here in Florida is August 18th. So we will talk to Jen next. It is, I am Nicole Sandler. It's the Nicole Sandler Show at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network. All right. I think they're in a break. While they're in a break, let me do this and see if I can't figure out why our levels are so low again. Man. All right. Give me one. So shoot. Oh man. Best laid plans and all that stuff. I was going to play, this. Yeah, I need to go here and we'll go here.
I'm Rick Smith. And this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day machinist John Connolly was fired from General Electric's Sprawling River Works in West Lynn, Massachusetts. Firings of several more labor activists prompted 14,000 workers, 40% of them women, to walk off the job and flood the ranks of the IAM and the IBEW. The newly established War Labor Board emboldened GE workers. They looked to the board for help in beating back yellow dog contracts and to organize bona fide unions. A metal trades council had finally been established at the GE plant in Schenectady, New York. Workers hoped to do the same at Lynn. After Connolly's discharge, GE managers fired another 14 activists 3 days later. As Joseph McCartan describes in his book Labor's Great War, thousands of outraged workers met the evening of the firings and determined there was nothing left to do but strike. The walkout began the following Monday. David Montgomery describes the scene in the fall of the House of Labor, writing, quote, early in the afternoon, union sound trucks outside the building blared fighting songs and called to down tools. Within an hour, the GE River Works were empty. The strike lasted 3 weeks. In that time, strikers defeated attempts at arbitration, demanding the board rule on their behalf as it had done for GE workers in Schenectady. In October, the board adjusted wages, ordered reinstatement of all but two of the fired workers, and established minimum pay for women. It also ordered the election of shop committees. Lynn River Works was now 95% organized. Victory was short-lived, however. In the post-war period, unions at GE and elsewhere were summarily defeated in vigorous open shop drives across the country.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.
The Nicole Sandler Show is 100% listener supported. Have you given yet? Nicole decided not to put her show behind a paywall, knowing that many can't afford the luxury of paying for a podcast. But if you're able to, she needs your financial support to continue doing this. Consider a monthly subscription. Give when you can. Just visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. Remember, she can't do this without you.
I am back, and I believe we have on the line Jen Perlman. Jen, are you there?
I am here. Thank you for having me back on.
Oh, thank you for being here. No, you know, are you no video today, huh?
Well, okay, I could do the video, but I'm in the process of actually I wasn't prepared for video. Do you need video?
No, it's okay. I mean, just, you know, all the people on YouTube, they see a lovely photo of you, and that's fine.
All right, but well, I'm working on it as really fast as I can. Maybe I can get on there in a couple of seconds.
Okay, well, that's all right. Jen, I'm glad you could join us, because we are in a horrible place right now here in Florida. And I'm not saying Florida is a horrible place, although we could debate that. But Florida just announced over 11,000 new COVID cases today alone, which is about the same as Texas had yesterday, except we have 25% less people than Texas does. So we're kind of screwed here.
I mean, a lot of us knew that as soon as we had Ron DeSantis, but, you know, given where we were coming from, we had a very low bar. So, you know, at first it didn't seem so horrible, but I mean, are we really surprised that Florida is handling this in the least efficient manner possible?
No, not at all. And my question is, I mean, look, this is a Ron DeSantis thing. This is something that the states are having to step up and take responsibility for, because the federal government isn't doing, pardon the French, jack shit. So it leaves it up to the states. Now, unfortunately, we're in a state with an idiot governor who, walks around following Trump like a dog, you know, licking his boots, who doesn't have a thought of his own without going to Donald first. And of course, we know where Donald Trump is on all this nonsense. So here we are. Ron DeSantis is still insisting that everything's just fine here. Really?
Yeah, we essentially have two layers of Trump. That's really what we have. I mean, when Ron DeSantis went in there, it was essentially, from my perspective, to ensure that Florida goes to Trump in this election. And so basically that's what his purpose is in even being in that position.
Right. And he seems to not, I mean, he seems to not care. I just think he's in so over his head that he just doesn't know what to do. There she is. There's video of Jen. Hi.
I'm like in the process of I have a 6:30 virtual town hall. So I was just getting ready.
But I see. Well, thank you for joining us. So our YouTube audience and the Facebook Live audience can actually see you there. Hi, good to see you. What should Congress be doing? What should our local congressional representatives be doing? What should Debbie Wasserman Schultz be doing? And has she done anything, to your knowledge?
All I have heard her talk about is basically just criticizing the governor and Trump. That's like the extent of all I've ever heard her talking about. I haven't seen her offering any sort of assistance for people that are having difficulties dealing with our state unemployment system, offering any resources, offering any help, being a loud platform for the people that have just all lost their jobs and or their health coverage, if they even had any. I don't see her doing any of those things.
Right.
So, I mean, obviously in the state, we never properly closed down in the first place. And that's the biggest problem. They never properly did it in the first place. So it was never really ever going to be an effective solution. And then they didn't spend the time building up the infrastructure that we needed them to do in order to be prepared for when the virus did come spike again. And so we weren't building up our infrastructure. And I mean, again, this is all about squashing labor and forcing everybody to go back to work before we really should be going back to work. And Florida is pretty backwards with these things.
Right. Oh, most definitely. It's really frustrating. I'm so glad that my kid is done with school, so I don't have to worry about sending her back. The governor has issued a mandate that school starts here early in mid-August and in just over a month that our kids are going to go back to school. And he wants 5 days a week, regular school. What should we be doing?
Well, I would actually urge people to use their own judgment with regard to the health and safety of their families, because we obviously live in a situation where the powers that be are not looking out for our best interest, but they're looking out for the bottom line of their investors and their donors in corporate America. So their goal is to make everything look like business as usual, squash labor, and force people back to work. And as soon as they lift the eviction moratorium, we're going to start seeing shanty towns all over the place.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well,
so I don't know how, the fact that they're telling people to have their kids back in school is almost laughable, because to be honest, there are so many people dealing with way bigger issues than that, that they're not even talking about.
Like what? What should be people dealing with right now? What should we be dealing with?
I mean, if we lived in the correct universe, we would have Medicare for all, and we would also have a UBI. The first stimulus package that went out that gave us that $1,200 payment, that was laughable. That was the $3 trillion slush fund for Steve Mnuchin.
Yep.
So, you know, when we talk about what could Congress be doing, oh, I don't know, maybe passing stimulus bills that help regular people and not just corporate America.
Well, that would be nice. Yeah. You know, speaking of unemployment, this is a perfect, Florida is so screwed up because allegedly people like me who are self-employed, whose incomes were cut due to the pandemic, we're going to be able to get a piece of it, get at least some assistance. And when I tried to do it, going through the forms, what I got to the point where, did you earn more than $275 last week? And I said, yes. So I'm ineligible. You can't earn, because Florida's maximum unemployment benefit is $275 a week. Who can live on that? Florida is in the Stone Age. It is so far behind everybody. So anyway, these things don't really, concern members of Congress, because it is a state more of a state thing. However, here we are, and people are grasping. We're just saying, help us, somebody do something. And it seems like nothing's getting done. So we take out our frustration on all of our elected officials, no matter who they are. But so, Jen Perlman, you are running in the Florida primary to unseat Debbie Wasserman Schultz and become the candidate in Florida's 23rd congressional district. Debbie's been there way too long. Two questions. Why do you think you can beat her? And why do you think you should be nominated over her?
I really believe that Debbie is no longer representing the majority of the district, the majority of anybody for that matter. So when you look at what we're supposed to be, this is supposed to be a term of service. It's called the House of Representatives, not the House of Leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have somebody that's been in there for, she's been there 16 years. She's been my representative for 16 years.
Wow.
But when you look at the policies that she supports, it is not in line with the majority of people. So that means that this person is failing to do their job as a representative. 72% of people want Medicare for all. She won't even have a meeting about Medicare for all. So, you know, how many people want legalization of marijuana? I think it's like 90-something percent of Democrats support the legalization of marijuana, and she still refers to it as a gateway drug.
Wow.
So we're dealing with somebody that, regardless of what her motives or her intentions or any of that, we don't even need to go, is not representing what most people want. It's that simple. So yes, there is a small niche. There is a people that are very big Debbie supporters. They are generally people, for the most part, who all of their basic needs are being met and everything is working fine for them. And so it's really a microcosm of what we're seeing at the national level with the people that are supporting the more centrist corporate candidates. It's if all of your basic needs are being met, then you're fine with the way things are. That's good, you know. So Debbie does not represent most people. And as far as why I think we can beat her, and look, if we had really fair elections, and we all know that we don't, but if we really had legitimate elections, yeah, I would put me against her any day of the week. But we're not dealing with that. We're dealing with voter suppression. We're dealing with a media blackout for me and a lot. And I've been blacked out of the local Dem groups. Like, it's really, I am going on the Progressive Caucus tonight.
Good.
As a town, but that is the only Dem club. And this is the first time is tonight. So they keep having sheriff things and state attorney forums, and they're pretending like my race doesn't exist. So I've been blacked out. And yet, despite that, we have reached communities and people that she can't possibly reach. She's capped. She's not going out and getting new voters. Mm-hmm. Nobody is waking up and saying, oh, I like that Debbie. I'm gonna vote for her. No. So she's capped at who she has. And it's really a matter of, can we get the young people and the disenfranchised people that we've been really focused on for the past year and get everybody out to vote? And will those votes be properly counted? So that's, you know, so I'm cautiously optimistic in terms of what we're doing here in our movement, but I wish I could feel more confident in the process.
That's been an ongoing battle, and that's going to be an ongoing battle for some time. So that's our fight to continue waging and do it in a better way. Now, you're also dealing with this pandemic where you can't go out and hold events and do the retail politicking that it takes. And I know that you were doing a lot of, you were having events and gatherings, and you can't do that. What have you been doing instead to meet people?
Yeah, so we have a pretty massive phone and text operation that's been going on, just like, you know, we would have normally, but because our canvassing has been somewhat limited, now we are back canvassing again. We're doing socially distant canvassing. We're being as conscious of the issues as we can. All of our volunteers have masks and sanitizers, and, you know, we're ringing doorbells and standing 6 feet back. And, uh-huh, you know, we're being as cautious as we can. And we're doing literature drops. We're doing a lot of social media. And this is somewhere where, because so many of my supporters are young people, this is an advantage that we will have on social media that my opponent will not. She cannot get the enthusiasm and that fire that you can get on social media. She just isn't. And most of her supporters are not really on things like Twitter or Instagram. Hmm. So we do have a certain advantage with that. Now, she has infinitely more money. Mm-hmm. And she's going to be blanketing mailers. I heard she ordered 5,000 yard signs. Oy. So they're going to be everywhere. But she's capped. And so we know that. And that's really what keeps us motivated, is to get all of those people that she can't possibly get.
I know the answer to this, but I have to ask it anyway. Has she debated you?
No, the closest we got was our joint interview with the Sun Sentinel, with the editorial board, which was laughable at best. And once they endorsed her, and I am quoting them, that she and I are virtually indistinguishable on our principles, quote. And then that was followed by the endorsement of Debbie. And then they were condescending enough to refer to me as I reminded them of a young Debbie 25 years ago.
Oh,
well,
my
here's
God.
The thing is, she's only 5 years older than me.
She's only 5 years older than me.
That's just insulting.
Oh,
she's
my
5 years old.
Well, you do look a lot younger than her, because she brings forth this old person's energy. And frankly, you don't. You look like a young, vital, you know, a person in the realm of AOC and the you know, that you could fit right in there. That speaking of that, Jen Perlman, your credentials, what makes you qualified to go to Congress to represent Florida's 23rd district?
It's been sort of a roundabout way to get there, but in a lot of ways, everything that I've done almost makes for the perfect person to do this, because my original background is I was a journalism major. I went to college for journalism. So my first and foremost, and I still feel in some cases doing this, that I'm in journalism mode. Like, I'm the inside whistleblower on this campaign process, every intention of letting everyone know every ounce of filth that's going into this. So like the journalist in me is still like in that mode. And then I have a degree in marketing and I have a law degree. And out of law school, I did a lot of criminal defense. I did a lot of work pro bono in communities where people couldn't afford representation. And I've seen some pretty ugly things. And, you know, working at the Chamber of Commerce in between marketing and law school, I spent most of that time at the State House and working with lobbyists that were promoting our policy to our members. Now, granted, it was the Chamber of Commerce. It wasn't progressive policy, but I really loved that whole aspect of policy and legislation. And that's when I decided to go to law school. So I sort of have a pretty well-rounded experience, and I volunteered, I think, on every presidential campaign from before I was 18 until really, I think I didn't do Obama's second term. But up until that point. So I've always been around politics. People have always told me I should run for office. It's really not that far of a stretch, just if you accumulate, you know, my background. But really, I'm just a regular person, and more than anything, I think that's what we need.
Yes, and you're very accessible, and you're a progressive, and that's certainly what South Florida needs right now. People can find you at jen2020.com. You're on Twitter at jenfl23. Any other things that people need to know? Any way that they can see you at an event online, or I guess not in person, anytime coming up soon?
Well, we are also, everyone know, Instagram is JenFL23 also.
Okay.
We need phone bank volunteers. Everybody can sign up on our website at Jen2020. And we do need help. I mean, we need to build up like a phone army, basically. And it is very safe. It is very easy to do. And we definitely need help. And we need donations.
Yes.
We absolutely do. I mean, we're fighting a corporate monolith. And I know that I hate asking for people for money anyway. But during this, it's been excruciating. We do. And so any way that people can help, and anybody in district, we need people to host yard signs. So any of these things, if you can host a yard sign, reach out at jen@jen2020.com. And you can sign up on our website. And also, you need to be registered as Democrats July 20th, which you can also find that link on our website as well.
Oh, awesome. Okay. I'm not in the district, as you know. I'm in Coral Springs. So I'm in the 22nd. You're in the 23rd. But my sister is in the 22nd. So I will call her tonight. I will make her, she's in Pembroke Pines. I will have her get a yard sign, and I will make sure she's on board. So because I'm not in the district, I'm going to call someone in the district and make sure that they vote the correct way, and that's for Jen Pearlman. Again, the election, that, you know, it's going to be early voting. We should be getting our ballots any day now, I would guess. And they've got to be in, or you can wait online on the 18th of August, but that's going to be a kind of a clusterfuck. So do as I do. Get your absentee ballot, fill it in early, and then hand deliver it and drop it off at the Supervisor of Elections office in Broward County so you know it gets put in the box where it needs to go. Jen, anything I can do to help, I would love to see you get in there. And we know it is a blue seat, so whoever wins this primary will win. Is there even a Republican candidate?
I think there's three.
Really?
It's kind of interesting. Yes, I think they're having a primary. And it's, I don't want to sound condescending, and I don't want to sound like that, but I mean, they must know the numbers.
Yeah.
So I really believe that they have other reasons, whether it's the experience or just getting their name out. And I'm not saying this in a mean way. Like, it's just, so I think it's nice, but the numbers just aren't there.
I hear you. All right, Jen Pearlman, it's great to talk to you. So tonight you're doing, it's the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Florida thing?
Yeah.
Awesome. Great group. My friend Susan Smith is there. And of course, you know, the spirit of Mitchell Stolberg will be there as well. Yeah.
Wait till you see our new Medicare for All commercial, because I have co-opted a very good video of Mitchell Stolberg. Aww. And that is our commercial for our Medicare for All.
Oh, awesome. Is it up on your website, or will it be soon?
We just did the editing, the final editing to it yesterday, and then we will be putting that out as an ad. And it starts off with Mitchell talking in his car about Medicare for All. And then it's really cool. And I checked to make sure his sister was okay with it, mm-hmm. and everything. And I know Mitchell would love having a video of himself.
And I think I know that video. I think I know exactly the video you're talking about. So very cool. Is that going to run actually on TV or just online?
I don't know. Definitely online. Definitely social media. We're having issues getting ads on Google. They're giving us the runaround and all this. So that's affecting Google and YouTube.
Aye.
But we definitely have a really solid piece that I think really looks cool. So we're going to be putting it out as many places as we can.
Terrific. All right. Well, Jen Perlman, I'm glad we could connect again. And we'll try to talk one more time before we get to August 18th, because I want to see you get in there and I want to get rid of Debbie. I mean, we've had enough. We'll keep drinking our dirty Debbies on Thursdays, but we want Debbie Wasserman Schultz out of Congress, and you'd make a great member of Congress. Jen Perlman, again, jen2020.com is the website. Go check her out and help her if you can. Thank you, Jen. Have fun tonight.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Bye, Nicole.
Bye-bye. Take care. Jen Perlman, she's the real deal. And yes, we're lucky to have her. And, I know it's a long shot. Debbie is so plugged in. She's been in that seat for, 16 years? Time for her to go home. She's got young kids that aren't so young anymore. Let her spend the last few years her twins have at home with them. Don't you think? I do. All right. Another quick timeout. We'll come back on the other side with my friend Jason Leopold. He is a senior investigative reporter for BuzzFeed News. And the government has dubbed him the FOIA terrorist because Jason, of all journalists working today, makes the best use of the Freedom of Information Act. And he scored not just one, but two huge victories this week. One of them of an urgent nature having to do with the Roger Stone, who is trying everything to keep from going to jail. And Jason Leopold is a journalist, and he's trying to get all the information that we need, we the people, so we can be informed about what Trump is doing for his buddy Roger Stone. So don't go away. Jason Leopold of BuzzFeed News joins us next. It's the Nicole Sandler Show, NicoleSandler.com, and the Progressive Voices Network. All right, so we got spots on Progressive Voices, and here on the Nicole Sandler Show, let's listen to Jim Hightower.
Once again, my state of Texas is saddled with a Republican gubernatorial goober. Greg Abbott is this guy's name, and he's another incompetent right-wing ideologue whose botched handling of our state's COVID-19 crisis makes Donald Trump look like a master administrator of public health. First, as a small-minded, small-government zealot, Abbott obsequiously followed Trump's lead of do-nothingism, pretending the bad thing would just drift away. As a result, droves of Texans were dying, so he rushed out to express astonishment and concern. Yet, he cravenly refused to offend his corporate and far-right backers by implementing such life-saving measures as business closures, requiring masks in public, and stay-at-home orders. Worse, the little petty potentate infuriated local officials by banning them from taking protective actions in their communities. Bizarrely, Abbott declared he was focused not on preventing infections, but on making sure there were enough hospital beds for those who get infected. He might as well have bragged that providing an adequate number of graves was his priority, for sure enough, thousands more Texans were soon dying because of his incompetence. Finally, Abbott the absent was forced to enact a stay-at-home mandate, but he declared it was not a stay-at-home order. Instead, it was essential services and activities protocols. Then he got really strange. After banning local officials from requiring mask wearing, he declared he had hidden a trick door in that executive order. If they could divine the riddle, the trick was that while mayors and others could not require face masks, they could require stores, bars, offices, factories, and other businesses to require masks. This is Jim Hightower saying, isn't that fun? Playing pandemic word games with people's lives. Critics who say Republican leaders have no sense of humor haven't met Greg Abbott.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
All right, so Jason Leopold is joining us. Now, here's the problem. Not really a problem. We actually taped this conversation yesterday because today's Jason's little boy's birthday. So I got it. Except it was about 4 minutes before I remembered to turn on the camera. So those of you watching on YouTube or Facebook, you'll see a lovely picture of Jason standing at Camp Justice at Guantanamo Bay until the point where I remembered to turn on the camera, and then the video kicks in. So through the magic of radio, here we go. Take it away, Nicole and Jason. Oh, boy. Joining me on the line today is Jason Leopold, who's been called a FOIA terrorist by our government. And Jason has embraced the term. And boy, today, I guess the terrorist wins. Congratulations, Jason. You had a big court win this week. Tell us what happened. This had to do with a Roger Stone case, huh?
Yes. So back in February, and this is going to get a little wonky, but this is, I'm going to bring you into the world of FOIA. So back in February, when it was revealed that Attorney General Barr had intervened in the Roger Stone case by essentially overriding the recommendations of the prosecutors who were on the case, who said that Stone should serve about 7 years in jail. Trump tweeted about it. Next thing we know, Barr gets involved, overrides their, you know, recommendation, which were in accordance with sentencing guidelines. I filed a Freedom of Information Act request to gain access to records that would kind of lay bare what, you know, went on behind the scenes. You know, the memos, the back and forth emails, anything that was relevant to this. And it was also right after we learned that he was also getting involved in the Michael Flynn case. So I filed a separate request for that. So I filed this request and I asked for expedited processing. And what expedited processing is that when you file a Freedom of Information Act request, if you can show that there's a compelling need, that the public needs to know about this on an urgent basis, because it would expose actual government activity, you can get that. And so I asked for it and the Justice Department granted it to me. Now, you know, I'm in a fortunate position because I can actually, you know, through the resources that BuzzFeed has given me, I can actually sue the government rather quickly. I don't have to wait. And the reason that I do that is because it takes such a long time to get records and to show what's happening, you know, while issues like this are playing out publicly. So I did that. About 2 weeks later, we sued the government, which we could do. We could do it in accordance with, you know, regulations under FOIA. And the Justice Department moved rather quickly to dismiss the lawsuit. And, you know, I started to get curious as to, like, why were they moving so quickly? They were trying to say that, you know, my request was an improper request. They were disparaging me to some extent in court documents. They, you know, essentially accused me of jumping the line. I should have waited. You know, everything that seemed to suggest that there was a delay in providing these records. And meanwhile, what did we see happening? We started to see prosecutors resign from the case. We started to learn more about Barr's role in intervening. Trump was talking about how Roger Stone would never not have to lose sleep at night, suggesting that he would pardon him. And so, you know, these are records that go to the integrity of the Department of Justice. You know, there were, I think there were more than 1,000 people, a 1,000 former Justice Department employees who signed an open letter. So the Justice Department continued to delay and delay and delay. And finally, you know, we had several court hearings where we were explaining that our request was proper and everything that we were doing was proper. The Justice Department put together this 18-page motion to essentially say, this case needs to be dismissed. And they went through a list of, you know, various cases that they said would, you know, back up their argument. So it was odd. And the reason it was odd, Nicole, is that even if the request itself was, let's say it was improper, and they said, okay, that's improper, you should, you know, you should have waited, I could have simply, they could have dismissed it and I could have simply refiled, right? But the reality is that they did grant me expedited processing. They did say, yeah, you're right, you did demonstrate that there's a compelling need, the public needs to know about this. So they spent 6 months trying to dismiss this case and made no effort to search for these records.
Wow.
And then finally, we had a hearing in the case on yesterday.
Right.
And yes, excuse me, yesterday,
meaning
Wednesday,
right.
Wednesday
right.
This week. And the judge really slapped him down. You know, the judge slapped down the Justice Department attorney. The Justice Department accused me of gamesmanship, manipulation. The judge in the case just, you know, said he wasn't buying it by the way in which that, you know, the department acted, and essentially said that, you know, yes, you need to process these records. But he, you know, the Justice Department revealed that even though they granted me expedited processing, they still didn't.
They did nothing. They did nothing. So for 6 months, so they granted you expedited processing, said, yes, we're going to rush this. It's a matter of urgency. There's a time constraint here. They granted it, and then they sat on it for 6 months while they tried to get it thrown out.
Exactly. That's exactly what they did. And next week, from what we know, at least at this point, unless something happens, you know, Roger Stone is supposed to report to jail.
Yeah.
And so why are these records important? This is not the way FOIA should work. This would hopefully, you know, help shed light on how Barr has politicized the Department of Justice.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not, you know, stepping out of my lane. I, by saying that, he's demonstrated it. So these records would have helped during the course of this prosecution, sentencing of Roger Stone, as it played out over the past 6 months, the public would have benefited by having this information in their hands and, you know, could see what was taking place behind the scenes.
Right.
But now, you know, it's not necessarily too late, but there's, you know, that time, you know, that valuable time is lost. Where it also could have, you know, perhaps, you know, it could have changed something, could have changed public thinking. It certainly could have helped if, you know, members of Congress, Barr is supposed to be testifying sometime this month, you know, could have helped them. So, you know, the reality is that It just underscores how difficult it is to, you know, to get at the truth, to get documents, to show how, you know, on the one hand, you know, you have this administration, and it's not unique to the Trump administration, because the Obama administration did it as well with regard to FOIA, but it's far more difficult here, where you have an agency that is trying to control the narrative.
Hmm.
Okay. And the narrative as it relates to the Mueller investigation, and which Barr is trying to rewrite to the benefit of the president by turning the entire investigation, you know, on its head, and everything that Mueller wrote to more or less discredit it.
Right.
And what I am doing is trying to get at those underlying records that may tell a different story. So during the past 6 months, they controlled the narrative while I'm trying to get the records that would, you know, perhaps show that there's another narrative.
Right. Now, so Jason Leopold, that the hearing, the judge who we should recognize for being fair was Judge Randolph Moss. Now, were you in court? Was this hearing in Washington, D.C.? You're in L.A., right?
I'm in LA. I wasn't in court. It was a telephonic hearing that they had, and you know, with my attorneys from Lovey and Lovey in Chicago, Matt Topic, Josh Birday, And, you know, they made the argument. I mean, the law was on our side. They also obviously made compelling arguments. And, you know, I think it's just becoming increasingly clear, you know, for people, for your listeners who are interested, is that it's really difficult to, you know, to not only get records, but to get an accurate sort of accounting of what's going on, you know, within the federal government as right. it relates to high profile cases and issues. And so documents, as I've told you, you know, as we've discussed numerous times over the years, are such an important element of the truth. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, this is just one example of that. And so, you know, like I said, we still have a parallel case as it relates to Michael Flynn. Wow. And so what I'm trying to do, the same way that we've done with the Mueller memos, with these FBI 302s that we've discussed, that, and those are the underlying interview summaries that Mueller used to write his report. You know, we sued for that. We got those records. You know, we got the Justice Department to unredact the portion of the Mueller report as
That's
it relates
right.
to
that was you.
Roger Stone.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a as far as I'm concerned, a historic victory.
Yeah.
So it shows, you know, that there's another narrative here. It really underscores why this is important, because then the public can see it. And it's not me saying to them, you know, there's an anonymous source here. But rather it's me saying to them that, here's the documents, the government's own documents, you know, you can see what they're saying.
Right. Now, so Jason, you have not yet even, this just happened yesterday. I mean, we're recording this on Tuesday because you're busy with your son's birthday tomorrow, which is a good reason for not being able to be here tomorrow. You haven't written it up for BuzzFeed.com, BuzzFeed News yet. I'm reading an article about it at law.com, which, yeah. I mean, the headline is just astounding. The headline reads, "I'm baffled. Judge questions, quote, good faith of DOJ in Roger Stone Records case." And it goes on where he talks. I mean, it sounds like he really smacked down the Justice Department.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm happy that's happened because, you know, historically what happens is that the government goes to court and makes all sorts of different arguments about, you know, FOIA cases and, you know, judges essentially defer to the government, you know. And so it's nice to have had, you know, these victories.
Victory. This is a big victory. Yeah.
You know, that the judges actually see that, you know, in this particular case, there really isn't a good faith effort, you know, that the government made. And, you know, these are my opinion, as I said, is that they're, you know, they were trying to control the narrative and, you know, the judge recognized that. So now what happens now? Now the government needs to very quickly process those records.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to come up with a production schedule. You know, when you get expedited processing, when you can demonstrate, and that burden is on me, I had to demonstrate that there is such an urgent need that they have to set aside everything, you know, and process these records on an expedited basis. And I demonstrated that, they granted it. So now they have to sort of make up for lost time. And the public needs to know, you know, particularly before the election, what was taking place behind the scenes. So we'll come up with a production schedule. I have no idea how many records are at issue. And hopefully, you know, we'll get to some sense of truth of what was taking place.
And what is it that you're looking for? Is this from the Mueller report, the Roger Stone segments, or you already got that? These are other papers having to do with Roger Stone's court case?
Yes. Yeah, this is completely separate. These okay. are records from the Office of the Attorney General
uh-huh.
and the Executive Office of U.S. Attorneys. I'm looking for any memo, email, directive, anything that would kind of lay bare Attorney General Barr's intervention in reducing
the sentence.
Reducing the sentencing
right.
of the sentence of Roger Stone.
Okay, so this is Right. This, and this was unprecedented. Yeah. So this happened after the sentencing recommendation was made, and then Barr comes in and says, well, you know, now we're going to reduce that a little bit, and orders the prosecutors on the case to change their sentencing recommendations. And if I remember correctly, didn't like four of them say, I'm taking myself off this case? A couple of them left the government altogether. One left.
Yeah, one left and testified. I believe it testified maybe a week or so ago for Congress. And and essentially said that there was, you know, that this was politicized. Wow. This was politicized to help the president's friend.
Right.
And so I want to see what was discussed. President Trump, you know, tweeted about it. Mm-hmm. I even asked for some records revolving around that. So, you know, I'm not saying that there's any sort of smoking gun there. I don't know what's there. But the reality is that, you know, what takes place behind the scenes, you know, that you can document is a bit different. And so that's what I'm hoping we'll get to see.
Now, when you say you've got another case brewing, basically dealing with Michael Flynn, does this also have to do with the after the fact? I mean, he pled guilty to lying to the FBI, lying. And now after the fact that, you know, he's getting ready to be sentenced. And again, Barr and Justice comes in and says, well, you know, we're going to drop this whole prosecution. They had already pled guilty. And so this is what your FOIA request is about. And is this also expedited, allegedly?
It is. Yes, it is. You know, and with regard to Michael Flynn, I mean, I am seeking pretty much the same records. Mm-hmm. I really want the public to understand, you know, what's been going on behind the scenes at the highest levels of the Justice Department. And so these are two prominent, high-profile cases that the attorney general personally intervened in, you know, that Trump has been tweeting about, that has been, that's been pressuring them to take care of. And so, yes, I'm looking for those records and, hopefully, you know, again, we'll get that before the election. But my goal here is to, you know, is not to allow the Justice Department to just control the narrative, you know, and that's what they're doing. And clearly I'm a thorn in their side as they, you know, as they noted in their, you know, in their court filings. And so, you know, hopefully we'll start to see, you know, some records come through. But I, you know, if the unredacted versions of the Mueller report are any indication, and in the event your listeners are not aware of that, you know, I sued the Justice Department last year along with the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC,
right,
to gain access to an unredacted copy of the Mueller report. I challenged the legitimacy and the lawfulness of the redactions. And this has been going on for more than a year. And a couple of weeks ago, the Justice Department released another version of the Mueller report, mm-hmm, that, you know, where in which they unredacted the portions that relate to Roger Stone. And very importantly, in that, you know, unredacted version, Mueller suggested that, you know, that Trump lied to the Office of Special Counsel in his written answers to their questions. I'm sure that's probably not a, you know, a surprise to some people.
No, but to have them affirm that is a big deal.
Yes.
Right.
It is a very big deal. And that's, you know, there's a very important, you know, summary of that. And in addition, it shows that that Mueller was Mueller's team was saying that that Trump was, you know, discussing WikiLeaks with and Roger Stone.
Yep. Yep.
Very early on. And that when he was asked about it, he
lied.
Likely, you know, misled them, lied.
He lied. In plain English, he lied. This is all great news, Jason. And actually, I saw a tweet from RCFP, that's Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. And here's what they wrote. This ruling is a major win for the public's right to access court records and for them, RCFP, Jason Leopold, and @_lightlaw, who have fought for years to unseal judicial records that will enable the press and public to monitor government use of surveillance tools. This is awesome. Once again, Jason, you're a hero. I mean, because especially at this time when we have such a corrupt DOJ, when we have an attorney general who has taken on the role as the president's quote, Roy Cohn, that they're doing everything. They lie to the public and they're trying to hold everything back. To have you fighting on our side is just awesome. And to see you notching up win after win is just, it's great news.
I appreciate it. Just, you know, for that, on that tweet that you read, that actually relates to another case.
Oh, really?
That's not this one. To another case that I won on this week as well.
Wow.
I don't mean to be sitting here patting myself on the back, but that's another case, another important case. It's outside of the realm of the Russia investigation or Roger Stone, but it's still within that kind of, you know, area of why it's important that we get records to understand what the government is up to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Jason Leopold, I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud to call you my friend. I just wish you lived closer. I was still out in LA because I miss you.
We can listen to tunes together.
Yes, I know. We really could. So what happens now? You wait for them to cough up the documents or any idea or the schedule?
The documents, they'll process it. You know, they'll obviously go through redactions. I mean, next week we'll probably get an idea of what the production schedule would be. And we'll go from there.
Wow. All right. So I'm guessing we'll see some more blockbusters at BuzzFeedNews.com pretty soon. Are you going to write up what happened over the last week with these victories?
I think we'll wait till we'll see what happens next week and then, you know, put a summary together.
Very cool. All right. Well, today's it's a good day, you know, as far as the courts go. Again, we're taping this on Wednesday when we've got the final rulings from the Supreme Court, which wasn't a slam dunk win for us against Trump, but it wasn't a win for Trump. And there was another, the third ruling today, which was actually the first they announced on Oklahoma being Indian land. I mean, today's a pretty good day, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's, you know, another day where what's going to happen today? And, you know, we wake up and here it is. So I think that certainly, you know, the ruling on his taxes didn't go for him. It's for Trump. It didn't go the way that he had hoped.
Nope.
And it didn't exactly go this for, you know, the public hopes to see his tax returns the same way. But it importantly, you know, the justice has said that the president's not above the law.
Exactly. And that's the takeaway for today. Yep. The president is not above the law. And, you know, Donald Trump needs to resign and release his taxes. Anyway, Jason, congratulations. I beam with pride that you're my friend. I'm so proud of you and I'm so happy for you. This is great news. And thank you on behalf of everyone for fighting for our right to know and fighting for the right of a free press in this country. The press has taken a lot of slings and arrows over the last couple of years. And, you know, some of it warranted. But I'll say most of it not. And, you know, it's called the Fourth Estate for a reason. We need you now more than ever, especially with an administration like this. So thank you for doing the difficult work. I'm seeing stacks of papers behind you. Are those FOIA papers that have come to you that you're reading?
My FOIA requests that I have filed over like 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
So I kind of collect them at this point.
I see. Well, better you than me, because I don't know what I would do with that pile. Jason, thank you so much. Happy birthday to your little boy, who's probably not so little anymore. And congratulations again.
Thank you.
Jason Leopold, he is the real deal, and he is so good at what he does. And we're really, really lucky to have him. And he is a dear friend. And just you know, he's every bit of as good of a guy as he sounds. What you hear is what he is. And by the way, he's got the best collection of rock and roll t-shirts. Every time you see him, he's wearing a different band's t-shirt. just in case you were wondering. All right. And with that, we made it to the end of another week. Thank you so much for bearing with me through the the equipment changes and the audio problems. And I promise you over the weekend, I will tweak it. I know it was a little better today. We'll get it good. And I'll get it really good for Monday when we do our Music Monday segment in the second half of the show. And James McMurtry is our special guest this coming Monday. I'm very, very excited. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone. Try to do something fun and take your mind off the news and the COVID and everything else. Okay, whether it be music or a good book or a movie or something, you know, in the comfort of your own home. Thanks again, everyone. See you next week. Bye.